From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Many of us are confronted each morning with our personalized news feed, whether the source is social media, a news app trained to select articles reflecting our preferences, or a TV channel. And pundits have blamed those sources for the societal divides we're seeing today, whether it shows up in a rejection of negotiation on Capitol Hill, or that uncomfortable moment when Uncle Steve criticizes the president while carving the Thanksgiving turkey. It's a well-documented fact that polarization is at an all-time high. The causes, however, are unclear. According to U.S. News & World Report, a study out of Stanford and Brown universities suggests older Americans, who tend to be less actively engaged online, have actually seen the biggest swings in ideological extremism. Those at least 75 years old saw more dramatic growth in polarization between 1996 and 2012. People between the ages of 18 and 39, who are much more likely to engage online, saw only a minor increase over the same period. That makes it tough to blame social media for America's polarized environment. While we may not be able to clearly identify the causes, we can figure out ways of bridging the divide. In his 19th century book on liberty, John Stuart Mill wrote, "Where there are persons to be found who form an exception to the apparent unanimity of the world on any subject, even if the world is in the right, it is always probable that dissentients have something worth hearing to say for themselves, and that truth would lose something by their silence." Really? We'll take that apart. Joining us now to help us take civil discourse out of the theoretical and into the concrete are two professors from the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. Dana Stachowiak is an assistant professor of curriculum and instruction in the Education Leadership Department. Dana Stachowiak, welcome to Coastline.
Thanks for having me.
Don Habibi is a philosophy professor in UNCW's Department of Philosophy and Religion. Welcome to the program, Don Habibi. And we are, of course, inviting you to be part of the conversation. If you have a question about handling a difficult topic in a sensitive situation, or if you've wondered about what it means to have a healthy debate and a constructive conversation, call us during the live Thursday discussion at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Don Habibi, you have written that our political divisions are actually contributing to a crisis of the humanities. What do you mean by that?
Well, the humanities have taken lots of hits lately for a number of reasons. One of them is budget cuts, and much of it is also that much more money and investment is going into the STEM curriculum, the science, technology, engineering, and math. So the humanities in some ways fades from importance. And what I've written is that some politicians are not just cutting budgets from humanities departments because of the budget crisis. I think some are happy to cut because they see the humanities, at least in many of the loudest voices coming out of the humanities, as being something that is radical but subversive, that in a certain sense it's tearing down a system that has built up over several centuries that allows the kind of freedom of speech and freedom of the press and all those freedoms. And so there is a perception that some of these voices that are very intolerant or stifle debate are a problem. And so I think certain politicians, one example would be Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, who took away tenure and was very happy to cut budgets. I don't think it was only because his hand was forced by resources going into STEM or financial crisis. I think there's a sense that the humanities are bringing down the rest of society. So that's
and that's one effect of this polarization. What are some of the other effects that we can actually observe and quantify, Dana Stachowiak, of this deep polarization that's happening in America? I mean, why do we care about it? Why can't we just go to our respective corners and stay there?
I think the simple answer is because we're human beings and we have feelings and we have emotions and we have experiences and we have truths and narratives that are real to us. And when we go to our separate corners, we don't recognize the solidarity. We don't recognize our interconnectedness. And then it becomes very lonely, and it becomes a place where we can sit in the things that anger us versus engaging in critical dialogue where we can have conversations that maybe not transform us to do other things but can help us to see other people's perspectives and maybe think differently about the ways in which other beings are seen in the world or how they navigate the world. And so I think, as Don was talking about this choosing to focus specifically on STEM, I think of in education, we often teach with the head in mind, and we forget the body and the soul in the art of education. And the focus on just our mind leaves out our personal narratives. But the reality is, when we walk into any situation, we bring all of our stories, all of who we are. And in the work that I do, we talk about this as being an assemblage of identities. And so, well, when I walk in a room of educators, the first identity that they see of me is that I'm a professor. But I also bring in my identity as a working class child, as a member of the LGBTQ community. I bring all of those pieces with me. And when we forget those pieces, we're forgetting really the humanness that we bring to situations, to experiences.
And in class, which is kind of a different circumstance, you identify all those elements of yourself.
Sure, exactly. One thing that I try to work on with my students is really being aware of who we are as human beings. Oftentimes, especially if we live in among the majority or among privileged, or we're part of a privileged identity, we don't ever have to name who we are. We don't ever have to name who we are when we walk in a space or declare, oh, well, I'm straight or I'm white. We don't have to do that. We don't have to use those signifiers. And so what I really work on with my students is really thinking about their wheel of diversity, the social constructs that make up their identity, and naming those. And then also not just naming, oh,
and why does that matter? I mean, how does that affect their worldview when they name, okay, I'm white or I'm straight, or I come from this particular socioeconomic class?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the naming matters, but it doesn't matter as much as if then you don't stop and question, if you're not critically reflexive to then say, and how does my whiteness or how does my straightness or my queerness, how do those affect other people and how do they affect my worldview? So that's when that naming becomes important, is then when we are back it up with being critically reflexive about how we impact the world and how the world impacts us.
Going back, Don Habibi, to this reference that I made in the introduction to John Stuart Mill and On Liberty, he was talking about even if the world is in the right, there's still value in hearing the dissenting point of view, even if we know that point of view is wrong. He says, truth would lose something by the silence of that view. How can that be? What is the value in the wrong point of view?
Well, we have our truths, and unless they're challenged or we're forced to defend them or articulate them, they become what Mill calls stale truths, and we lose our deeper understanding of those truths. So the exercise of free and open discussion, the marketplace of ideas, where supposedly truth emerges from its collision with error, is a precious, valuable exercise in refining our knowledge and sharpening our views and our understanding. So it's a kind of a win-win situation. It might sound odd to people, but the idea that prevailing views get challenged is, first of all, how certain revolutions in our thinking or paradigm shifts happen. You know, people used to think the Earth was the center of the universe or the sun orbited the Earth. I mean, there's all kinds of examples in, say, the history of science where somebody's thinking out of the box and there's value in that. Even if they're wrong, they force us to rethink what we take for granted. So all
which is the appeal, for instance, of President Trump to many people. There were a lot of voters who said, this guy calls it like it is. He is not bound by the restrictions of political correctness.
That's true. I think that's one of the things that made him appealing to people. And, you know, what's quite shocking or interesting to me is that he had so many things that he's done or said that would disqualify any other politician. But he sort of not only broke all the rules, he basically threw out the rule book and said, I'm not playing by those rules. So in that sense, I think some people thought, oh, this is a breath of fresh air. This is somebody who's different. It'll be interesting to see this process unfold. But he sort of took on the role of being an alpha male, that he's going to do what he wants. He's going to say what he wants. And he made all these people scratch their heads and scream and shout, but he just kept on going. And so that was an interesting phenomenon. When I wrote this humanities piece, it was the primary season. So, but the thing that made Trump catch on is that he just defined himself in a completely different way. So there was a ready audience who wanted somebody who's not a professional politician.
I want to talk more about that too, about the idea of political correctness and repressing one's thoughts, one's honest thoughts, versus engaging in a healthy debate, what that really means. You're listening to Coastline, and we're exploring the practice of civil discourse with two UNCW professors, and we're taking your questions. What kinds of situations do you find yourself in that are the most difficult, and where do you consistently feel you hit a wall in communicating with people of other points of view? You can call us during this live Thursday edition at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. We're taking a closer look today at why the practice of civil discourse is becoming more important than ever and how two UNCW professors advocate for using it in daily life. With us today is Don Habibi, professor of philosophy at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, and Dana Stachowiak, assistant professor of curriculum and instruction at UNCW's Education Leadership Department. And they're answering your questions on this Thursday. You can call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Just before we went to break, we were talking a little bit about what is so appealing to people about President Trump and what a lot of people describe as his lack of political correctness, his unwillingness to be bound by stale ideas about what's okay to say and what's not okay to say. He'll just come out with it the way he sees it, and that resonates with a lot of people. And Don Habibi, you were kind of talking about, you know, his taking on the role of being an alpha dog and just charging ahead with what he thinks, which is so different from what we think of as political correctness. Dana Stachowiak, can you talk to us a little bit about this backlash against what people call political correctness? And what is there a difference between being politically correct and walking on eggshells to not offend someone and having a frank discussion that does kind of embody mutual respect? I mean, are those two mutually exclusive ideas?
Well, I think what has happened, we've lost the art of having good conversation. We've lost the art of thinking of the other person as a part of our conversation. We are in a culture of fear. We're in a culture of how can I get ahead and what's the fastest way that I can get ahead? And that oftentimes we stop thinking about the well-being of the whole. So when I think about the work that I do, I advocate for what Paulo Freire referred to as radical love. And so it's this idea of it's really what civil discourse is based in is understanding the well-being of the whole and being it's not about politeness, but it's also not about rudeness and anger. It's about the good of the society. And so we need to come to conversations, and we need to have the tools when we come to those conversations to be able to not just listen to people's perspectives just to have a response, just to have the best response. I'm on Twitter a little bit, and I'm often waiting for when the next big news happens, somebody who's going to come out with the best tweet that's going to get the most retweets and the most action. And we're focused on this versus focused on actually sitting back and listening to people to hear what they have to say. And I think if we spend a little bit more time stopping and thinking, okay, so that's their narrative. It may not match with my narrative, but that's their truth. And we talk about truths. It's hard for me to say, well, you're dead wrong. That's wrong. That's not right. I mean, in some situations, obviously, we can do that. But people's truths are their truths. That's the way that they've experienced the world. And their reactions to their truths and their experiences may not be the best, but their truths are their truths. So what we need to maybe be interrogating is, how do we react in these situations versus you're right versus you're wrong?
Well, how do we engage, first of all? Because if your truth is really different from mine, why do I even care about what your truth is? What would make me want to step out of my particular milieu, whatever that happens to be, and enter yours? What's the value, especially if I know you're wrong?
I think that when we start to hear other people's narratives, we can more interrogate our own narratives and think about the impact that we have, that our actions have on others. I might make a comment that I think to me makes perfect sense and feels really good and it makes my point, but then it's going to trample on somebody else's narrative, or it's going to hurt their feelings. And if I don't stop to hear that, we're going to continue to argue. We're going to continue to not meet in the same place. And we can see it right now. Things are not moving forward in Congress, right? Because we're not listening to each other. We're just responding to each other. And we're at this holding point where nothing productive is happening. So I think the good that comes out of stopping and listening to people and really hearing their narratives, whether or not we agree with them or whatever, is that we might be able to, in that moment, find some type of common ground, find why we're in this struggle together. What's the collective struggle for the better good? And I think that once we start to hear other people's perspectives, we can start to see what that collective struggle is and then decide how we're going to get there. And you might get there in a different way than me, and I might go the other direction. But instead of going in a direction where we're constantly fighting and just sitting in one place, we're both going to start moving forward for the better good.
Alina from Wilmington asks, how can we have a civil discussion when, okay, now just inherent in her question is a position, and this is interesting. How can we have a civil discussion, she asks, when one side claims fake news or alternative information or misinformation? We can't have a rational discussion if the other side is being irrational. Don Habibi, how would you address Alina's question?
Well, it's a good question. If the other side is being irrational, my first reaction is, well, there's a lot of that going around. There's a lot of irrationality out there.
And the other side probably thinks that about you.
Correct. So I think all of us have to be a bit more humble and a bit less judgmental in terms of assuming that people are irrational. But it's not an unsafe assumption. I think the thing that makes it worthwhile to dialogue with people and talk to people is that we can learn from them and we can sharpen our own views if that's the result. In other words, I might learn from arguing with somebody who I disagree with vehemently. I also learn how they think. I might see the flaws in how they think. It might reinforce what I think, or it might start poking holes in what I think. And in either case, it's healthy. And I think we all have to have a bit thicker skin, meaning not to be so sensitive as far as our own personal feelings in terms of just understanding other people. Because often they don't mean to hurt. They don't mean to take, you know, swipes at you. They're just being who they are, or they're living their truth. But my personal opinion is it is hard to talk to people who really are irrational or who have such a different mental paradigm that nothing you say is going to get through to them. But we can learn from, because there's a lot of people like that.
This might be a good time to bring up political analyst David Brooks writes about dealing with what he calls fanaticism. And there was a particular column where he wrote about this. And some people just took umbrage at his use of the term fanatic. Like, wait, so this is my point of view and you're calling me a fanatic. And that I think that's a separate issue that we can get to if necessary. People compare that to Hillary Clinton's basket of deplorables. Like, I don't share your point of view, so I'm irrational or I'm a fanatic. And he writes about in those situations when you're opposite someone who does have that point of view that is so extremely divergent from yours that you fight your natural instinct to silence that other person, that other view. He says there are some ideas like racism that are so noxious they deserve no recognition in any decent community. But if instead, he writes, we regard this person as one who is, in his twisted way, bringing you gifts, then you'll teach the world something about you by the way you listen. And he says you may even learn something. A person doesn't have to be right to teach you some of the ways you are wrong. Dana Stachowiak, have you ever encountered, can you think of a specific time when you encountered someone with a really divergent point of view, and maybe you didn't wind up agreeing with them, but you learned something about yourself?
Sure, that's funny. I jokingly was talking to my friends about, can you believe that the person that I was in my younger years is being asked to have a conversation about civil discourse? I used to be really passionate and I use that in quotes. I used to be pretty angry I would always need to prove, and I probably still have a little bit of that in me, but I would always have to prove the other person wrong or prove that my point was the best and I would do anything and wear myself out until they would agree with me or just give in. And I learned a lot about myself when I stopped and sat back and went, well, why am I always angry and everybody else is walking away angry too? Why aren't we getting somewhere? And so the way that I think about entering situations now, I think that was stated beautifully as stopping and listening. We can really learn a lot about ourselves if we about our reactions. So I was talking about reactions. It's more about how we react to those situations. So you have to look at each situation. I can think of one I was in recently where I had to really look and go, what's the value in this?
The value in the argument.
Uh-huh. What's the value in the argument? If this is a person, a so-called fanatic, who's so off the base and from my point of view, is this 10 minutes that we have, this interaction, even going to change their worldview? Probably not. And so in this small amount of time that I have with them, what am I going to do with that that could also teach them? I think of myself when I'm really angry and I'm really passionate about something or just want to have my voice heard. That's the bottom line, is I want to be heard. And so I kind of put myself in the other person's shoes and think, you know what, right now they just really want to be heard. And so maybe I just let them talk. And I say, instead of, you know, saying, well, I don't really agree with that, just say, I hear where you're coming from. I hear what you're saying, or repeating back to them. So what I hear you saying is, and it's not necessarily me affirming that I believe them, but it's me affirming that that's their truth. And that I've seen a shift in the way that I react to people and then also the way that they react to me. It's kind of like, oh, wait a second, you're listening to me and you're affirming the value of my statement. And then after that, that opens up dialogue of, okay, so you've valued me and my statements. That must mean you're willing to listen. And so I'm going to give you some space to listen to your points as well. And then I've seen conversations be able to move forward. But then there are also other times that I've been in situations and thought, there's no value here. I can't do much in 10 minutes. I'm going to move on. And I think that's also really hard because there's pride and ego that comes into play and we want to prove our points. And I like being smart and the best, and right, that comes into play. But there is so much to learn when we just sit back and listen. And then I think other people then can learn about the ways in which they can navigate that conversation too that might be a little bit more civil.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking today about the challenge of engaging in civil discourse in the face of potentially fiery and divergent opinions or difficult situations. With us to answer your questions, Don Habibi. He's a professor of philosophy in UNCW's Department of Philosophy and Religion, and Dana Stachowiak, an assistant professor of curriculum and instruction at the Education Leadership Department at UNCW. You can ask your own question during the live Thursday discussion by calling 910-343-1138 or emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. Tom from Wilmington called in and said, harping on diversity can further fractionalize us. Can we just focus on laws that protect all individuals despite any certain identity? Don Habibi, how would you answer Tom?
Well, I think he has a point. I think that there is value in people having whatever collection or assemblage of identities, but I think also there's value in just recognizing we're all people, and we're all people with our flaws, and we carry our baggage that we've inherited or taken on. But I think there, at a certain point, it might become more easier if we just see ourselves as people. And again, I'm not saying anyone should shed their identity or there are multiple identities, but we can sometimes focus on what we have in common as opposed to what makes us so different or what makes us feel like we're not as much of a citizen or not as much of a member of the community. But in other words, there's a danger in going too far in one direction and a danger in going too far in the other direction.
What do you make of that Stanford Brown study that I referenced in the introduction that basically shows it's older Americans who are polarizing more than younger Americans? Does that mean that this phenomenon of extremism and division is going to die out? Or does it mean that we just get crustier and a lot more rigid as we get older? Don Habibi?
Well, I have not seen the study, so I have no idea if this is like really brilliant social science or this is social science as I know it, which is always a bit more suspect than what I would call the exact sciences. But
even out of Stanford and Brown.
Even out of Stanford, especially out of Stanford and Brown. So my quick take on that is I think the reason that older people might be more polarized is because some people are sort of stuck in the worldview that they had back in 1955. And some people, you know, who are old people now, have moved with the times or reconsidered, you know, how they were taught and how they were schooled and their upbringing and their older views about this group or that group. I think a lot of bad ideas were, or unchallenged ideas, from their childhood, from their formative years, might be in need of some rethinking. But I think some of the newer ideas might also be in need of rethinking. So the fact that older people are more polarized just says to me, I think that some people move with the times and change their views, and some people are steadfast in their views. I think that's my quick reaction to that study, which I do not know.
Dana Stachowiak, when you teach multiculturalism to your students, you talk about building a critical community in the classroom. Tell us what a critical community is and how we might build one outside of the classroom.
Sure. So critical community, that idea comes out of the work of several folks, but it comes out of the work actually of my partner, Sylvia Batez. She's done a lot of work on critical community, and it's basically this that we recognize and honor the interconnectedness of everyone's identities in the room. And we recognize that we are part of multiple communities throughout our day, and those shift. But then we also bring them into whatever community that we're in. And so that we honor that, and everybody's voices and experiences are honored and valued. And so when I talk to my students about cultivating that community, it's based on five things. So I talk to them about operating through the world on with this vision of radical love. So that's what I talked about earlier. It's not about political correctness or politeness or rudeness, but it's really about focusing on the well-being, the whole. I also talked to them about committing to having a commitment to solidarity. So it's this collective struggle for the better good. Paulo Freire, a Brazilian revolutionary educational philosopher, reminds us that we can't liberate ourselves by ourselves, but we also can't expect somebody else to liberate us. And I think that commitment to solidarity is important, remembering that we need to work together. I also encourage them that open dialogue is what we need to focus on. It's dialoguing across lines of difference. It goes back to engaging in critical conversations and then being reflexive listeners, where we stop and think, how am I impacting the world and how is the world impacting me? And that's, again, where it's the study and the struggle. So we stop and look, and then we think about how we can move forward. And it's where we listen to hear, not necessarily respond. And then the last one that I talked to them about is action. So this is where we start to ask, well, so what? And now what? What do we do? And this is where resistance and revolution and peaceful protest and transformation can really start to happen. And this isn't to say that we need to have radical love first and then commit to solidarity, but it's to remember that all of these things need to be functioning throughout, and they need to be interconnected in the ways in which we navigate the classroom, we have conversations with our students and the world outside of the classroom.
Okay, we're about to go to break, but when we come back, I want to find out how, if I'm willing to listen to you, but I know I don't agree with you, and I don't want to become a doormat, and I don't want your wrong ideas to start leading the charge. So just want to talk about really what a frank conversation means and how I can step away from losing my own identity. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. It's a conversation about civil discourse and the cultural roadblocks to it. We have two UNCW professors with us today answering your questions on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or coastline at whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. It's a discussion about civil discourse and the polarization of Americans. Answering your questions on this Thursday, Dana Stachowiak, she's an assistant professor of curriculum and instruction at the Education Leadership Department at UNCW. Don Habibi is a UNCW philosophy professor. And you can reach us with your own question on this Thursday by calling us at 910-343-1138 or via email at coastline@whqr.org. So I'm willing to listen conceptually anyway, Don Habibi. And I'm, you know, intellectually intrigued by this idea of John Stuart Mill's Marketplace of Ideas. But I don't want to become a doormat. And I don't want to lose my own identity. And I don't want to lose my own powers of critical thinking by taking in what you have to say so deeply. How do I get past that? Should I? Can I lose my own identity? Could I become a doormat by listening deeply to you?
Well, I guess it all depends. It depends who you're talking to and what your identity is and to what extent they are trashing your identity or laying a collective guilt trip on you or hitting the nail on the head. In other words, all of those are within the realm of possibility. My main reaction is it's very good to go through life with your eyes wide open, thinking and examining and reexamining your ideas. So just to digress slightly, where I was an undergraduate, which was UCLA and UC Berkeley. UCLA has a place called Bruin Walk, and Berkeley has Sproul Plaza. And on any given day, there's probably 30, 35 different groups that have a table set up with their literature or with their books. And on any given day, if I want to get in a discussion, an argument with any of a number of, communists or socialists or Christians or Catholics or Muslims or Republicans or Democrats. On any given day, the Spartacist Youth League has a table. The Young Socialist Alliance has a table. The Communist Party of America has a table. And I think one of the best parts of my education was talking to people, arguing with people, and some of them are very skilled. And that forced me to sharpen my skills. And there were also times where I thought I had a good idea and they just shot it right down or went on the offensive and I felt very humbled. But in the fullness of time, this made me a better thinker and better at understanding other people. And it really got to the point where I kind of know what this group or that group might say because I figured out how they think and how they see the world. So this was something that really helped me. Now, it doesn't happen at UNCW, which makes it much more peaceful, by the way. It's like much more pleasant. But
is that good?
It's good and it's bad. It's good.
Is it repression?
Is it a
politeness? Is it political correctness?
No.
Is it
no.
unwillingness to deal with the truth?
No. It's just there is not, say, some public square at UNCW where all these different groups have their table set up on a daily basis. So it makes it more pleasant. I can get more work done because it takes a lot of time out of your day. And some of these conversations leave you shaken up. They leave you stressed out. They leave you in a state of mind that you're not able, that I wouldn't be able to focus on my work. You know, as I could be very upset sometimes. But because of this experience, I've, without too much problem, have participated in many debates here in Wilmington. And it sharpened my debating skills. It sharpened my ability to think on my feet. It sharpened my ability to really understand different mental paradigms, different worldviews, and know where they're coming from. And some things, you know, sometimes people have a very good point, and sometimes people are fanatics or crazy or irrational, or we're just on two different levels of how we see the world. So, and that's the reality of people. But I found it very valuable and very educational, and I spent a lot of time with this, but it was well worth it.
You found taking in other groups' points of view to be valuable for your own education
very
and your
enriching.
Own critical thinking skills.
Yes. Yes. Being challenged was good. Being able to challenge and change their thinking or poke holes in their thinking was very good. All of this, in a certain level, is empowering and, as I said, educational. And so I found that a very valuable part of my undergraduate education. And when I was in graduate school, I was at a university, Cornell, which has, among other things, the best agriculture school in the world. And so there were students from all over the world, literally all over the world, with all kinds of opinions, some of them very insulting, some of them very, very bigoted. Nonetheless, I made lots of connections and lots of friends, and this was all, I think, to everybody's benefit. So it was not something that left me wounded and an oppressed victim. It's something that gave me a perspective and a handle on the world that I live in.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're talking about the challenge of engaging in civil discourse in difficult situations. With us to answer your questions, Don Habibi, professor of philosophy at UNCW, and Dana Stachowiak, assistant professor of curriculum and instruction at UNCW's Education Leadership Department. A few minutes left to get your question in. 910-343-1138 on this Thursday is the phone number. And the email address is coastline@whqr.org. Catherine writes, I think the ugly divide in this country is not one between political parties or policies, but one of how you view your fellow human being. Political correctness has developed negative connotations when all it essentially means is being aware that we are all diverse by nature and that we should treat each other with mutual respect. If you're a human being, you should care about human decency. Catherine writes, Trump is hardly an admirable guy for saying what people are thinking. Like so many who support him, she says, he's just a bigot who's incapable of realizing that people who are different than he is are not less than he is. And it's labeling that makes all of this dehumanization possible. It's a lot easier to make blanket fear-mongering, hateful statements about religious groups or ethnicities or genders or groups who identify one way or another sexually than it is to hate the human being behind the label. We're a far cry from a country that knows or understands the golden rule, and I don't see a middle ground or meeting of the minds for people who view humans who are different than they are as something to be feared or dismissed. Dana, does Catherine have a point? Or is there, because I think she kind of brings up the crux of the big political divide here. She says it's not political, but, you know, there people who seek out diversity in lifestyle and identity and points of view are different from the folks who say, I'm so tired of having to walk on eggshells around people. I'm so tired of political correctness. Is there no bridge there?
I think there's a bridge, and we're in the middle of having to build it and walk on it at the exact same time right now. I have hope for humanity. I really do. I think, are we in a really tough place? Yes. I think it's really challenging for me as somebody who is often othered in spaces. It's more challenging for me to go in spaces now than it was even a year ago. And so I'm faced a lot personally with being seen as the social justice warrior, the person who's always pushing for diversity. And I think what happens is we, with political correctness, we don't understand what diversity means. It's now become a divisive term to mean something negative. Diversity just means being aware of the differences in the world, and then it's what we do with that awareness that matters. And so I think that it really comes down to part of building this bridge to lessen this divide or bring people together is education around what do these topics really mean. It's having candid conversations about, you know, Don said earlier, we look at each other as human beings. We care about each other. We need to get back to that. And I think she's right. We've labeled in order to not have to face looking at somebody in the eye. If somebody looks at me in the eye and sits down and has a conversation with me, they're going to see a completely different person than they see when they just look at me and say, oh, well, you don't fit the norms of gender, or you have a female partner, or you're a woman, and so, you know, you're different. It's easier to be angry at those things than it is to be angry when you look at the heart and soul of a person. And so I think she does have a point there. But I also would argue that there is hope, that we just need to keep building this bridge. And I think we have the pieces. We've had them in the past. We have ancestors. We have civil rights movements that have given us these tools. We just need to use them differently now, today. And I think that's part of the issue. Part of is we have these tools. What do we do with them? Or what do we not do with them?
There was a piece published in the Paris Review after the 2016 election written by John Jeremiah Sullivan. And he writes, it's one of my most strongly held beliefs, and has been for my whole adult life, that we don't really see each other when we observe from a distance, that you have to get close to know anything at all, and even then, often don't know. Don Habibi, is there a divergence between the idea of building a bridge and encouraging this marketplace of ideas?
Say the question. Is there a divergence?
Yeah. I mean, are those kind of mutually exclusive, like, you know, fiery debates? I'm thinking of, you know, the public square on campus, mm-hmm. on the West Coast, UC Berkeley, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Versus building a bridge with someone who is so completely diametrically opposed in worldview from you. Are those two different things that we're talking about?
Yes and no. Sorry, I'm splitting the differences here. I think building a bridge and the marketplace of ideas get along. I don't think that's a contradiction. I also think there are some people for which there's really not much point in building a bridge, because we are, you know, for lack of a better word, enemies ideologically or politically or nationalistically. There's lots of different kinds of people, some of which have something you could learn from. Everyone has something you could learn from. But some people, it might not be the best investment because you're at cross purposes. But the one thing I would say to Catherine in her concerns is I would think the best thing Catherine could do is travel and go to other countries. You know, get and see how discourse and dialogue and all that takes place in a variety of other parts of the world. And I think when one gains that perspective and puts everything into a much more human context, an international context, a global view, Catherine might find that there's more ability to speak one's mind and think one's thoughts and get access to information here than most anywhere else. So instead of seeing, you know, the negative, and there's lots of negative out there, in the relative scheme of things, I think she would encounter much more visceral hatreds and ethnic divides and suppression of speech and thought if she were to see the world. And I think that's a very healthy thing for everyone to do. I encourage my students, any opportunity for overseas travel, take it. It's never a perfect time, but just take it.
We had Michael from Sunset Beach called in, and he makes a really interesting point here. He says, I think people on both the right and the left believe Congress is inept. However, he says, Trump is a liar and unethical. Michael says, I have a hard time separating Trump from Trump supporters. I sometimes think these supporters are just like him, but I know them. But I know among them are good people, too. Is that an important distinction, Dana Stachowiak, separating a politician from his supporters? And why is that an important distinction?
I think it's absolutely an important distinction, but it is a hard distinction. And I think, you know, I know people who are Trump supporters, too, that I converse with and are really great people. And then I look at them and think, well, this doesn't make any sense. I don't know how you can support this man and be the person that you are and living in the ways that you are. So it is really.
And they probably think that about you.
Exactly.
If you were a Bernie or a Hillary supporter in the 2016 presidential
right.
election.
Exactly. But I think it's an important distinction to make because. And even just speaking for myself, too, I think that we haven't spent enough time on either side thinking about what somebody else feels or what they don't feel. So I might look at this person who I would never think was a Trump supporter, or somebody might look at me and think, man, they'll probably look at me and think, well, you're a Bernie supporter, of course. But they might look at me and be like, oh, I can't believe you support that candidate. But oftentimes we get so entrenched in our ideals, and if we find we gravitate towards one person matches that or a couple of things, then we say, well, that's the person. And then we kind of forgive the other things or say, well, I don't really agree with that, but I agree with the majority here. And so I think for that, giving the people the benefit of the doubt is that those places where they see that Trump aligns or whomever aligns with them, that's real to them. But let's try to find the good in that person, and then how can we work with the good in that person? And I think that's just giving the person a fair chance of having value in this world. But it is incredibly difficult. It's hard for me to look at, you know, I was parking here today and there was a Trump sticker in front of me and I was parked really fast because I got really angry. But then I had to stop and say, that person is going to a restaurant that I would go to. We have a common, there's something similar to the two of us. And so I think seeing the person as an individual is an important aspect.
Seeing them close up.
Yes, exactly.
That's this edition of Coastline. Dana Stachowiak, Don Habibi, thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Associate producer is Rachel Keith. Production assistant is Caitlin Hanrahan. Caroline DeVries is our webmaster. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org, get the podcast, or find it on the WHQR app. Tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 2 p.m. Join us for Coastline Live Wednesdays and Thursdays at noon here on HQR News 91.3 and 98.9 FM. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.